Would you be able to survive one day, just one day, without your television, without your computer, without your BlackBerry? Our grandparents didn't need them. Some of our parents lived without them. And yet these technologies are now an integral part of our lives, for better or for worse. Where will the wired world lead us next? And will we be happy with what we find there? Tonight, live from the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, Wired 24/7, the coming technological age.
Tonight, on The Agenda with Steve Paikin.
Nowadays, technology, everyone needs it.
Hardwired.
He has his hands off the steering wheel.
From driverless cars.
It steers for you.
To smart houses.
Computers that recommend a healthy meal based on what's in the fridge.
From bionic bodies.
There's two sensors on each side. That's what controls opening and closing of the hand.
To the future of the human race.
You'll be able to open your garage door, activate in-house security or lighting systems, and do it all via the web using the phone.
There will be no light switches. Instead, we will use sensors.
The roads match, the entire navigation experience matches what they would find in the real world.
If technology is the future, where do we fit in that future?
Just what do you think you're doing, Dave?
Wired 24/7. Part 2 of The Agenda at the Q2C Quantum to Cosmos Festival. That's tonight on The Agenda.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin. Funding for The Agenda with Steve Paikin is provided by Vale Inco Limited, a pioneering nickel mining company transforming mineral resources into essential ingredients for everyday life. Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome again to the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics here in Waterloo. We're at Q2C, the Quantum to Cosmos Festival, featuring some of the best and brightest scientific minds from around the world. Tonight, part two of our five special broadcasts on some of the most scintillating scientific topics of the day. TVO is proud as well to be a media sponsor for this event. We've been here since last Thursday. A lot of buzz around Waterloo, all of it very positive about the festival and the excitement around it. First of all, for those of you who have come to the Perimeter Institute tonight, we welcome you here in the hall. For those of you watching us at home, thank you for joining us as well. We've got several ways for you to get further involved in the broadcast tonight. Our fifth column blogger, Mike Miner, is hosting a live chat. You'll find that on our Inside Agenda blog. Or you can take part at twitter.com/theagenda. Use the hashtag #YourAgenda. Simply go to our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda, to get all the details on that. Now, let's get to tonight's topic. As technology transforms our daily lives, are we happy with where it's leading us? To debate that tonight, Neil Gershenfeld. He is director of the Center for Bits and Atoms at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Ramon Laflamme, faculty member and physicist here at the Perimeter Institute, and director of the Institute for Quantum Computing at the University of Waterloo. Jaron Lanier, author of You Are Not a Gadget, and interdisciplinary scholar in residence at the Center for Entrepreneurship and Technology, University of California, Berkeley. Neil Stevenson, author of Cryptonomicon, and most recently, Anathem. And Tara Hunt, marketing and social media consultant, and the author of The Woofy Factor. Great to have all of you who have come from quite near and quite far tonight to be with us. We really appreciate your time as we go to part two of our five parts here in Waterloo this week. I want to start by reading something the New York Times published just a few days ago, and it goes like this. Access to a fast internet connection has become more than a convenience. It's become enshrined in some countries as a legal right of all citizens. Finland, for example, announced last week that it was moving up its timetable to next year from 2015 for guaranteeing broadband access to all. Okay, Tara, first question. Can one really exist today as an engaged citizen in the world if you're not wired?
I think you can, but it's getting more and more difficult as more and more of our lives move online, whether it's our governments, news media moving online, all the conversations moving online. Of course, there's still lots to do offline, and I would argue, as many would, that getting out of your house from behind your computer and actually getting your hands dirty is a better way to engage, all in all. However, to find out where to do that, you still need to be online.
You got to go online to find out how and where. Jaron, what do you say to that?
I would say that there's a certain kind of skill to being online well, and that it is too often the case that the way people use their online time actually has an effect of disengagement. For instance, if you hover around websites that you agree with and fail to visit those that you disagree with, you're not really fully utilizing the online world to be a good citizen, and that's become very commonplace.
Let's go to Neil on this end. What do you say?
So I think for a group like this, that's a question that kind of gets answered by irrelevance. You could ask, can we live without electricity or heating and ventilation? And it's part of the fabric of our lives. What I find really interesting about that question is the margins of the internet today, where the internet is extended, where it hasn't reached before, where that question really has a transformative impact on society. And we can talk some more about that.
We surely shall. Neil Stevenson?
Well, I think a lot of essential activities are moving to an internet-only basis, whether we like it or not. So I moved recently and had to shut off a utility account. And it turned out that the only way for me to do that was online. There was a web interface and pretty much nothing else. So if that kind of trend continues, then I think there is some logic behind what the Finns are proposing.
Okay. Ray, this is home base for you, so I've let the guests go first, and you're the host in some respects, so you get to go last on this. How do you answer the question?
If we look at Waterloo, in fact, if we look at a few miles outside Waterloo, there's a Mennonite community of people who still go with horses and buggies around, and that makes a very good example of, in some sense, the clash of society of the highly wired people and the one who have completely no contact with it. And I would say part of the amazing thing about Parameter Institute is that this clash leads to new ideas, new way of thinking, new way of looking at things. So being wired, everybody doing exactly the same thing, I would say would be something that we don't want for society. But having both of them, both different point of view at the same time, this is what makes really neat things happening.
Jaron, pick up on that if you would. The Mennonite community he refers to may be, you know, for a Southern Ontario community, about as unwired as you get. And yet, I'm sure they would tell you if they were here, they're leading completely fulfilled and happy lives. So is there a conundrum here?
Yes, I'm actually staying in the Mennonite community while I'm here, and it's absolutely fascinating. And I hope that we retain some diversity in the styles of life that we lead in the future. I do think that there's a danger that the internet has a tendency of bringing people so closely into their peer groups because they find each other online that they live in a way a narrower life. And I appreciate what the Mennonites are doing. I was really charmed by it. A little jealous, perhaps.
A little jealous because?
To spend all day away from the gadgets gives you this connection to life and nature that's less mediated. You're seeing less of your own take on life embedded into the way you perceive life, and I think it's remarkable.
Tara, do you think they have any idea what they're missing?
I would imagine they're not entirely in a bubble where they're at, but I think they probably see a good dose of both the positive and the negative effects that come from the world around them being so wired. I know myself, just moving out of Silicon Valley back to Canada into Montreal and trying to take a step back from my wired life has dropped my stress level a great deal. So I'm pretty sure they take a look and they laugh, or they take a look sometimes and they think, well, maybe that might be useful.
But I've read your stuff and you didn't mind the stress level up here when you were in the midst of it, right?
Well, when you're in the midst of it, yeah.
Yeah. Neil?
I just want to flag a premise in that I don't quite agree with. The Mennonites without the gadgets have metallurgy. They have sewing machines. They weave fabric. These were all really advanced technologies. So I don't really buy that there's with and without technology. There's a continuous evolution. Each time a technology comes in, we go through the spike. And then it again gets answered by relevance. So I think the interesting question is good versus bad technology. It's not do they or do they not have technology, because they really do.
Other Neil.
Kevin Kelly, formerly of Wired magazine, has written a piece called We Are All Amish Now, in which he talks about the fact that he knows some people who they refuse to have an answering machine in their home, but they watch TV, and other people might be the other way around. And so if you talk to your friends, you'll probably notice that in every household there's certain pieces of technology that they just hate and refuse to have anything to do with, and others that they kind of warmly embrace and wouldn't consider living without. And that is what these kinds of groups are doing. As Neil points out, they're not rejecting all technology, they're making choices as to which ones they want.
Let's just broaden the discussion to look around the world a little bit more. And we have a graphic to indicate, let's bring this up, Michael, if we can, the penetration of internet use in populations around the world. There's Africa with the least penetration anywhere in the world. Only 6.7% of the population have access to the internet there. In Asia, up a little more, 18.5%. The Middle East, only about a quarter of the people enjoying the use of the internet. Latin America and the Caribbean, about 30%. Then you get up to more developed countries, you're into Europe, where half the people have access. Oceania and Australia, up to 60%. And not surprisingly, in North America, almost three quarters of the people have access to the internet. The socioeconomic divide between wealthy societies, Tara, and the developing world, is it widening even more because of this equation here, the internet access to it or not?
I would say yes. Especially since the technology that we're talking about is creating the next generation of jobs, is already creating many of the jobs in our world. It's pushing a great deal of the collaboration that leads to entrepreneurship, to growing people's knowledge base, so the knowledge divide increases as well. So I would say yes, if you're not getting the access to the internet, then you're falling behind even more.
Okay, and for those who heard the introduction, Woofie, that's a Doctorow reference, but tell me what's the reference there?
It appeared in Cory Doctorow's book, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, and it refers to social capital. In a basic sense. So a different sort of currency, which I think really is being driven right now by how far we can reach our networks, how much we can display our knowledge through the internet.
Jaron, let me pick up on something you said earlier. I guess I'm sort of in the middle of this transitional generation because I remember the way things used to be when a fax machine was considered cool, when VCRs first came in, and this was a fantastic new development. Now, Blackberries, wired 24/7, like a lot of people nowadays. And I wonder, is this progress in your view?
It's ultimately up to how well you use them. And to go back to the Mennonite community, I think I didn't see them with a magazine in the horse and buggy cart. even books, magazines are very, very old technologies. Might not be used at every moment that's possible if you want to use them as well as possible. And I think I love digital technology. I'm as wired a person as you could find, and I spend a lot of my time building exotic virtual reality machines and whatnot, which are at the very cutting edge of what's possible now. And yet, I think it's just essential to remain aware of how you're using technology and not to become a sort of an automaton within your own machines. Just assuming that they're always the best way. You have to use them skeptically to use them well.
Ray,
that's
maybe,
true for books, too.
Sure. It may be heretical to say this in the institute funded by the guy who invented this thing, but we are, I suppose, in some respects, slaves to this now if you don't use it properly. So, is that progress?
So there I would disagree, because you can turn it off.
Yeah, but
now,
who does?
It is hard to turn it off, but you can. So I do also, between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m., it doesn't come in. But you can do things with these devices that you would not be able to do before. Connect with people from all around the world at your fingertip. The source of knowledge, the amount of information that we can access is mind-boggling. And it is there, it's just us that we can go and pick it up. You mentioned a little bit earlier about the third world and Africa having very kind of low ability to get on the internet. There is quite a step indeed, because you have to have a computer, you have to have some line and wireless. But once you're there, it is free and you can get all this information. So there's a good part of democratization of the information.
I think Neil Gershenfeld wants to take issue.
I want to amplify this question about haves and have not. There's a sense in which the places that aren't connected are going to skip over the stage we're in. The way we get online now is you can pick whether you're mad at, I don't know if I'm offending sponsors, but if you're mad at AT&T or mad at T-Mobile or mad at, pick your provider. But one of the most interesting things happening in digitization is letting people make technology themselves locally. And so your number for the Middle East was 23.7, not 23.6, perhaps, because one of our field labs is in Afghanistan, where they've been using it to create wide area telecommunication infrastructure, not top down from a telco, but bottom up from the community, creating their own connectivity, then getting access to the outside world and online. And it's really transforming communities. But there, the internet isn't something sort of done to you. It's something people create for themselves. And so I think what's really interesting is when people take control of their technological future like that, and they create the internet rather than passively consume it.
But that's the key. I've got two Neils here. I'm going to say other Neil. Sorry, you forgive me because I went to him first. But
I'm honored to be the other.
Turning it off is hard. People don't turn these things off. They are slaves to them. And, you know, do you appreciate where they're coming from when they feel like they're slaves to this thing and this may not be progress after all?
Well, I get it, but you do have to take some responsibility for your fate and organize your life in a way that's going to work. Now, you know, there are people who are in professional situations where it's expected of them that they will always respond to emails quickly. And so in that case, I think maybe you're a slave to your employer, but you shouldn't blame it on the technology per se. People who have to make things, who have to focus on a particular project and not be interrupted, not be distracted, find ways to do that. They turn it off, they go into a special room in the house, they set the ringer so you can't hear it, and they find a way to get that 3 or 4 hours of continuous flow state time during which they can be creatively engaged on one project.
Tara, were you a slave to technology at one point?
Absolutely.
How'd you get out of it?
Well, one day I realized that I almost burnt my kitchen down.
How'd you do that?
Because I got into a conversation on Twitter without, I was boiling potatoes in the other room, and an awful smell and black smoke started to pour into my... this is a true story. This is how bad it was getting for me. So I just about burned down my kitchen because I was so focused on what was happening online that that flow state, the off, you know, made me totally forget that there was something crucial in the offline world that
so
I needed.
So almost
to get
burning
to.
Your house down, that brought it home to you.
Yeah, I mean, I had little other things up to that point that were triggering, that were saying, oh, you have a problem. Of course.
Jared?
I since you confessed your moment of realization, I'll confess mine. For a while, I blogged on one of the prominent websites. It was the Huffington Post in my case. And I realized that in sparring with the people who wrote in, I was turning into exactly what I dislike, just being partisan, argumentative, and not being as nice as I would like to be. And I realized that I was actually letting this context get the best of me and that it was really time to withdraw from it.
How did you actually disengage, though?
You know, this is the thing, you are in control. The machines are actually inert. They only run because people operate them. They
you
have
say
no,
that, but I, you know,
they have no autonomy, so you simply stop.
You
it's
say that,
it's amazing.
How many times have you talked to somebody who just said, I can't turn the damn thing off? I can't disengage from technology. I need it. It's a part of my life so much now. 24/7, wired all the time.
Right. Well, you need this little realization. Either your kitchen has to burn down or something, and then this moment comes about where you realize, actually, I am an autonomous human being. I can choose.
Well, do you know what I did? I used technology to help me remind me not to get off technology. Uh-huh. So I would use, like, Google Calendar alerts to tell me that I had to get off
to
of Twitter.
Okay, right.
I know.
Ray is an addiction?
I think it's empowering, as we can see.
Yeah. Well, the biggest thing is that when you're offline, you're worried about what you're missing all the time, right? So either you're missing some great information, because Twitter isn't just like a fun place to converse with people. I get so many great ideas from what people are posting, links or projects that they're working on, that sort of thing. And when I'm not on Twitter, I miss all of that. So there's one thing, there's the whole I'm missing the party kind of problem. And number two is just the opportunities that I can create in my life. My entire being, my whole profession, the only reason that I pay the bills every month is because I've been working the network online so much.
Neil Gershenfeld, how have you avoided the technology addiction?
By turning it off. My cell phone makes calls that go out but don't go in, and I do email once a day. And
you don't receive phone calls on your cell phone?
No. Does anybody else here not have a phone turned on? Oh, two hands, three hands. I don't leave it turned on. I limit the time to communicate.
You're a better person than most.
But it's just not that hard. There's a switch. And again, just about every technology has this conversation. When laser printers appeared, there was an epidemic of bad typography when everybody put too many fonts on a page. And we worked through that phase. Now there's a notion of visual design. And, you know, typography is good. And there was a time when it was really interesting to ask, can steam trains beat horses? And it was seen as very, very important. And we have trains and we have horses. It's important to zoom out and realize that there's a long history of this conversation. Yeah. And consistently, these conversations get answered by irrelevance. We master a new sense of literacy and grow past them. So in a sense, I think we're already on, that we're having it means we're almost done. And what's really interesting is what's going to come after this.
Okay, hold off on that discussion. We are going to get to that. But since you mentioned history, I want to go to Ray and pick up on the historical angle here. I want you to take us back, and I don't know how many years this is, 50, maybe even 60 years. IBM introduces its first ever business machine, and you've got a story related to that. So tell that story, if you would.
Around 1942, 1943, at Los Alamos National Lab, which was the place where the Manhattan Project came about and the atomic bomb, and many of the scientists who were there needed to have calculation to be done, so they were using computers at the time, and computer was not what you had in front of you today. They were the spouse of the scientists, and they were sitting down with pencil and pen, and people would come, they had a row of them, and a foreman would come and say, we have to compute this and this and this. And then IBM came with their machines. And there was a physicist at the time, Richard Feynman, and he loved to play tricks and to challenge people and everything. So he decided to have a race between the women computers and the IBM machines. And then he did this race, and he concluded that on the short time scale, the women were much faster and much quicker. But the machine can last longer, like 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 24/7, being on there. So that's how kind of the machine won.
Okay, that was a long time ago, though. So how's it happening nowadays? How much progress have we made in computing since then?
Progress is tremendous. So we've moved from these electronic machines to the computers that we have today, which are made with transistors. And when we look at transistors, we look at the size at which they evolve. So to make computers faster, we try to make the brain of the computer smaller and smaller and smaller, so the piece of information, well, then the bits of information can talk to each other faster and faster and faster. So that has been the trend for the last 50 years, and it's called Moore's Law. So every 18 months, we can pack twice as many transistors per unit area. So the size of transistors, when they were kind of created or invented, were about 10, about a centimeter. Like you could see them about that size. And today, transistors are about 30 nanometers, about 100 atoms. And so we've gone all that way, and we're going slowly to the area where we will have one atom per transistor.
Do you imagine that that kind of progress will be infinite?
No, it's going to stop, because after, when we arrive at the atoms, it's going to stop there. In fact, on the way there, it'll be really interesting, because as we go from the scale of system that we have, like you and me, or centimeter size, the laws of physics are described by what we've inherited from Galileo, Newton, Maxwell, etc. We call this classical physics. But when we go to the size of atoms, new things happen. Like, the physics becomes very different. There are some things which seems to be mind-bogglingly different. Objects can be at two places at once. They can be here and there. You can make experiments where you look at, try to explain what you've seen in that experiments, and the only way you explain it, we say, these particles of light, photons, or these atoms must have been here and here at the same time.
But if I'm reading between the lines properly here, and let me go to Jaron on this, it sounds like you're saying, Ray, that we're going to hit a wall at some point in the future where you just can't make any more progress. Jaron, is that, yeah, you see that future?
Well, yeah, I mean, there must be a limit to how much information processing reality can do. So, there, you know, and there are some pretty good ideas about what that limit is already. You know, so we know that there's a limit, but there's always a limit. We live in a world of limits. We are not gods, right? And I think the interesting question for me is the progress of software, which has not been so dramatic as the progress in hardware. In the case of chips, we can draw a square around the chip and define exactly what it's supposed to do. And in a sense, Moore's law is our learning curve, where we can understand better and better this orderly world that we can perfectly specify. In the case of software, we have this more out of control thing, where the software has to deal with reality, which we cannot control. And so software has actually become incredibly expensive and difficult to manage as it gets bigger and bigger. And that's actually a very interesting trend. And I wonder where it leads. It's a completely different process.
Don't you think that's a business problem, though?
Partially? If only.
Question from the floor back here, everybody. Go ahead.
All right, so as I look around me and I look at all the people that came tonight to watch this live, I wonder, why are they not at home watching this on TV, or maybe take a nap and then watch it online later? What are they looking for? What is it? Is it some sort of rejection of technology? They want the experience face-to-face? Is it different from the experience of TV? What is it they're looking for?
Okay, Neil Gershenfeld, there's still something about being there, isn't there?
Yeah, it's not hard to make that precise. The specs of reality are much better than these things. if you look at the resolution of the eye, if you look at the chemical signals you're getting, if you look at the air flows in the room, if you look at all the sensory input, what you get at home is just a very low resolution, tiny fraction of that. Again, these questions get answered by irrelevance. When the display, we run a global video network, and once the video performance started to match the eye for certain applications, people went from saying, I can never do it, to doing it all of the time. The specs of reality are much better than the technology most people use, and so you don't do it.
But don't you think when we have better processors, better information processing devices, you'll be able to have not only the picture, but you have the smell and the feeling and the wind that comes towards you.
And so again,
you.
The example I just skipped over is I run a global video network, and when for just a one-on-one close-in conversation, when the specs got roughly as good as talking to somebody close in, everybody went from I hate doing this to doing it day in and day out without even thinking about it once you pass those thresholds.
So what I find is an interesting phenomena is people around the world that use Twitter, right? It makes their lives really efficient. We tweet all day. We're ambiently intimate with each other's lives. Well, there's also a global movement of what's called tweet-ups. So people actually physically, in person, IRL, meeting face-to-face, putting their phones away into their bags so that they can talk.
That actually happens?
Yeah, face-to-face. I know, crazy. you can talk face-to-face with other tweeters. And this is growing and growing and growing. And I wonder if, computers can be more clear and provide smell and maybe push chemicals out and that sort of thing. But I don't know, it's going to take a heck of a long time to get to the point where we can actually replicate that, I don't know, the electricity that I think that human beings have.
Neil Stevenson.
I've often had a very similar question about a strange ritual that we do in my line of work, which is called the book reading, where the author is physically transported around the world and goes into places with a copy of the book and reads out loud from it for a while. So most of us aren't trained I certainly don't think I have any particular talent for reading out loud, and the content that I'm reading is available in the book. So
it's sometimes on tape too, like an audio as well.
Yeah, yeah, you can, you know, it's gettable. So so from a pure information theory standpoint, it's ridiculous to move somebody around in meat space and have them read stuff that everybody can read for themselves at home. But it's a very popular kind of activity anyway, and
how do you sign a book if you're reading in one city and they're in the other city?
Well, I believe Margaret Atwood has solved that problem.
Oh, she did that, didn't she?
Yeah.
What do you call that thing?
It's the...
Some kind of pen.
Yeah, DigiPen or... No, that's a product.
Something.
Anyway, it's a remote-controlled... Yeah.
You know what, though, Jerry? I mean, we sit here tonight. We're, I guess, about a month away from what is arguably one of the great national institutions, great national events in this country anyway, which is the Grey Cup, the annual... championship of Canadian football, and 40 or 50,000 people are all going to be in one place at one stadium. Yes, there will be 3 million at home watching it in HD, not getting the smells of it yet, but certainly getting, you know, a great sense of the excitement about it. But there's nothing like being there, I presume. Isn't that fair to say?
Well, of course, this is one of the central questions in virtual reality research. And what I believe is that one of the benefits of advancing media technology is that our own acuity is getting better and better as we experience these technologies. So I think these days, their customers who care about what audio format they download into their pocket gadget for listening to music. Is the MP3 good enough, or do they want something better? And I think that would have been unimaginable 30 years ago, because I don't think people had the acuity to tell the difference. And so our own ability to perceive the world improves with experience, and I think we stay ahead of virtual reality and the other media technologies. But there's a philosophical point, which is, I think it would be a mistake to assume that we understand reality completely and that we understand everything about how we perceive each other. And if we really become satisfied with some sort of virtual presence, and I work on these technologies, so I'm a great advocate for them, but if we become satisfied with it, there's a danger that we're losing some little thread of sensitivity to the mysteries of nature for what we don't know yet. And I don't want to lose that thread.
Can you just follow up on that a little bit insofar as this is completely coincidental, but you know, we have a new law coming up in this province of Ontario where you're no longer going to be able to talk on your cell phone in your car. And so I guess I, like many people, are running around these days buying a Bluetooth, which is, you know, hands-free, so I can talk on the phone in the car.
Right.
And it, you know, I spent 45 minutes fumbling with it trying to figure out how to get it to work.
Sure.
And you know, do you see a future where that won't be necessary?
Yeah, I absolutely do, because, I mean, we can't drive cars as much as we do because we kill each other. I mean, you know, just this is one of the stupidest things we do. We kill each other in car accidents at a far higher rate than we kill each other in wars or by spreading diseases around, you know, unless that gets worse, which is possible. So what should happen is driving should become a pleasure that's done as a pleasure on occasion for that purpose, and otherwise we need to have collision avoidance machines in our cars that prevent us from killing each other. And at that time we'll be able to text again while driving, because we won't have to drive. You know, I mean, this will solve itself, and it's urgent that it does. It's a very, very critical problem.
Okay, but Neil Gershenfeld, the Bluetooth thing that I got yesterday is an external contraption that I hook on my ear. Do you see a day coming where that will simply be directly implanted into my brain?
Technologically, it's feasible, but I think on balance, the people I know thinking about that are just less interested in it, because all of the devices around work well enough. And again, for me, your question leads into why do we have these gadgets and who designs them? And the really interesting question, I think, is not where do you buy a Bluetooth headset from, but a bigger question of what technology do you want in your life and who's going to create it? And there, the technology itself is changing the answer to that question.
Just curious. Jaron, do you see the day coming when it's going to be directly implanted? You're into the virtual reality thing.
Yeah, I mean, people are always fascinated with this idea of implementing virtual reality by directly connecting to the brain. And what I always tell them is that they misunderstand the brain, that the brain doesn't... The metaphor we have these days is that the eyes and the ears are like cameras and microphones that you plug into these USB connections in the brain. And this is not the way it works. There's no definite distinction between the brain and the eye. The brain grows up within the embryo in connection connection to the eye, and then as you grow up, they form their structures together in childhood. If you got rid of the eye or you got rid of the ear, you'd have to simulate them in order to have the language with which to speak to the brain. So from the point of view of information flows, you can't remove them. And so the whole question has an absurd quality to it that's based on a misunderstanding. So, you know, it's one of those things I can't answer you on the level because it's a poorly formed question. I'm so sorry.
I do it every night, trust me.
Okay.
Let me do this here. We're about two-thirds of the way through the program. We're going to just take a moment to remind everybody that we're broadcasting tonight live from the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario. It's the second of five programs we're doing all week here at the PI. We are part of Quantum to Cosmos, a scientific festival, worldwide gathering of some of the leading scientists and scientific thinkers. If you can't be here with us tonight, we invite you rather to join us online. Our web page is tvo.org/theagenda. If you go there, you'll find our Mike Miner hosting his fifth column blog on the Inside Agenda, Inside Agenda blog. He's hosting a live web chat there right now. Last night, I think we had twice as many people as normal joining us, so check us out there. While you're there, you can check out last night's broadcast as well as web-exclusive video. Hey, is this appropriate given where we are? Web-exclusive video of string theory scholar S. James Gates and his lecture, Does Reality Have a Genetic Basis? You won't get that anywhere else. All that, plus complete festival coverage in live streaming video, video on demand, tvo.org/theagenda, and also at twitter.com. Okay, did we have a question in the audience here? Let me grab the mic, and where to? Sir, you'll stand if you don't mind, please. There we go. Go ahead.
My question is, in a lot of technology, especially with great technology like this, there's always the good and the bad. What do you feel the bad side of this is, if any? Is there any pitfalls we should watch out for?
Neil Stephenson, what's the dark side?
Well, you know, in my country, 19 guys with box cutters took down the World Trade Center and half of the Pentagon. So, I mean, the sort of basic answer is that you can take anything, even as trivial as a linoleum knife, and you can do terrible things with it if that's what you want to do. Beyond that, I don't. Unless you're talking about some kind of technology that obviously only has bad purposes, like nuclear warheads, I don't think that you can really draw any useful distinctions.
Okay,
there.
Well, Tara, let me try this with you. We'll go a little, not quite so evil a reference here. You lived much of your life online for a while.
Yes.
Everything. It was all, it was open doors, it was open season. You blogged about everything that was happening in your professional life, in your personal life. You lived in a very open space. Was there a downside of doing all that?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
besides the fact that we all know way too much about your private life, what's the downside?
Yeah, so I basically rendered myself undateable for the rest of my life. But there was a downside. And the downside was that I think everybody that spends enough time online and starts to get benefits from the attention that they're getting online starts to think about the way that they're living their life, like what it's, I call it selective transparency. So we disclose a lot, but we disclose things that we think are going to entertain or be interesting, that sort of thing. And the problem was that I wasn't really addressing the things offline that I should have been. So main example was the relationship that I was in. It was not a good relationship for either parties that were involved. There was only two of us in that relationship. just to be clear, so it wasn't working. But because we had such a beautiful online perfect image, I was ignoring that part to focus on this online facade. And I do this in other parts of my life. I ignored a lot of what was going on offline, including boiling potatoes, whatever, to focus on this perfect facade that I was creating online. And that was a downside. But it's not the technology's fault. I think technology itself is as Neil said, pretty much neutral. It was me and my, a lot of us can fall prey to getting a certain amount of attention, I guess, from
from growing an audience.
Okay. Neil, tell us this. If we are, I think we all know what the basic, and sorry if this is the wrong word to use, but I think we all get what the basic toys are out there these days in terms of technology. You see people with them in their ears on the streets and so on and so forth. What, you're shaking your head already? You hate the question already?
No, I love the question.
You love the question, you hate the way I phrased it?
Yep.
Okay. Okay.
You're doing fine. Keep
humor going. Me for a second then. What's coming down the pipe 10 or 15 years from now that we're going to see people either walking down the street on their heads, on their ears, playing with, doing with, whatever?
So this is the thing I'm most involved in right now. You get digital communication. That's what's letting people watch online. You get digital computation. That's what's filling our pockets with all of this stuff. But this whole evening has had this notion that there's cyberspace with all this information and then meat. But that's fundamentally wrong because you're a computer. You're programmed with molecular codes. You run programs in your body. And the most interesting for me personally, research frontier, is we're learning how to digitize fabrication. So you bring the programmability of the digital world to the physical world, and just like the app for digital computing was a personal computer, the app for digital fabrication is a personal fabricator that lets you make anything. Just, these are a couple examples. This is a $10 internet terminal.
Just hold it up still for a second, and we'll get a camera on it.
Instead of mass producing a computer, I mentioned this lab in Afghanistan, or we have these all around the world. This is a $10 internet terminal that's not mass produced and shipped, but made locally by users to connect to the internet. This is a microfluidic thermometer. You probably won't even be able to see the details for healthcare for a few cents made in one of these labs. This is a 3D construction kit that my kids invented playing in one of these labs. The point of all of these are, and there's lots more examples, we decorate nests, we, you know, express ourselves. We're in this little window where technology means what you can buy at Walmart or pick out at Amazon. And the impact of this digital fabrication is ordinary people get to create their own technology, not as a business for marketing, just as sort of expression of who they are. And my experience has been there's this radical swing. It touches something deep, unlike anything I've encountered anywhere in technology, where as soon as technology isn't something done to you, where you're awash in it, designed by somebody far away, but it expresses who you are and what you want, it's empowering, it's exciting, it's transformative. And so I think the real answer to Wired is leaving cyberspace and coming out into physical space where we live and programming the world around us. And so the reason I was shaking my head is it's not a matter of which earpiece. In the class I do at MIT on this, one student made a thing that can save your scream and release it later when it's convenient. And one made a dress that's instrumented and defends your personal space if somebody comes too close. And one had an alarm clock that was too easy to turn off, and so she made one you wrestle with to prove to the alarm clock you're awake. And, you know, those
it's
things, for me, are the answer. It's not incremental changes in a Bluetooth headset. It's expression.
I should just mention that if people go to our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda, Sandra Jonas, on her blog post, has got links to all of those items that you just held up there right now. So if people missed it or want to see it again, they can go there. Ray, I want to talk to you about the future of healthcare and what technology possibly offers there. So what can you tell us?
I think what we'll see in the next 5 or 10 or 15 years is the advent of many sensors. So we already see sensors in cars. That's how they kind of control the amount of fuel air that comes in your engine and planes and or in your cellular phone. It changed the backlighting and all of this. But we'll have much better sensors and much smaller ones. And I can easily imagine having sensors going to your bloodstream, be able to analyze on the way down what's happening, finding if you have tumors somewhere by getting very near them. And then you can imagine them with something like nuclear magnetic resonance or MRI, and then being able to learn like this. So we'll be part of this flow of information, be able to kind of know all of this very easily.
You got to explain that to me. How's that going to work? That's 5 or 10 years away, you think? Those kinds of in-body sensors?
Already we do some of this. Like in some sense, a vaccine is something that you inject in yourself and do something. We don't talk to them anymore.
But you're saying a sensor that can pick up the first hint of a carcinogenic cell. You're saying that's possible within 5 to 10 years?
Maybe 15.
Maybe 15, okay.
But
Jared, what's on your horizon?
I've worked on something that we call an artificial gland, which is an extension of that, where you'd have a little chemical factory in your body that can respond to what you sense. I know you're interested in these, in putting things in your body, so I thought I would mention that. This is your obsession
for
some reason. Yeah, and such a thing could happen. And in that case, you could imagine the internet doing to pharmaceutical companies what it did to record companies, where the designs for drugs would just flow around on the internet and be synthesized within bodies rather than in factories. Such things are technically feasible in all likelihood. I mean, until they happen, we can't be certain. I think we have a very huge looming question about how to structure society in a situation in which technology becomes really able. Because our way of running market economies, our way of running politics, all of these things are based on assumptions of scarcities that we might not have. On the other hand, we might have other very severe scarcities based on global environmental conditions and, for instance, fresh water, or we might solve those. But there's a huge variation. So I'm very concerned about what sort of society we'll be able to navigate through these extraordinary uncertainties that we're bringing about. But I think we have good reasons to believe that overall we're doing far more good than harm by increasing the level of technology. I personally believe that if we had flying cars now, we wouldn't have terrorists, because the young men would have something to do that would really fascinate them. I think to some degree technologists keep the peace by expanding wealth and expanding the repertory of experiences to please everyone.
Okay, in our last 5 or 6 minutes here, let's go into one last thing, and I want to read an excerpt from Kevin Kelly, who of course does Wired magazine, and had this to say a couple of years ago at the TED conference. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the next 5,000 days of the web. The next 5,000 days, because the web is only 5,000 days old, it's not just going to be the web, but better. It's going to be something different. It's going to be smarter. It'll anticipate what we're doing. In a good sense, it'll become much more personalized. It will know us, and that's good. The price of that will be transparency. It's going to become more ubiquitous in terms of filling your entire environment, and we will be in the middle of it. And all digital devices will be portals into that. So there's only one machine, and the web is its operating system. All screens look into the one. No bits will live outside the web. To share is to gain. Let the one read it. And the one is us. We are in the one. Okay.
Can I tell you a story about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, back down to earth here, and let's get some feedback on that. Go ahead.
A couple years ago, I did an installation at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, where once a decade they do a show on architecture. They had a lot of electronic information, but the curators forbade terminals because they didn't want you typing on a computer in the Museum of Modern Art. So we filled the furniture with instrumentation and had video projection integrated throughout, and opened, and there's a problem because people were more interested in that than the show, but an elderly museum benefactor came shuffling up, pounded on the table, and said, "I love this, because I hate computers, and there's no computers here." And the table she was pounding on had 400 microcontrollers and had about 20 separate IP addresses. She was completely surrounded by computing, but it was exactly that, because it disappeared. She couldn't say, and I couldn't say, the computer. It was just a responsive environment. So, as written, that sounds threatening. From her, it's you no longer have to type on the terminal. Your environment is helpful. And I think that's where it's going.
That's very funny. Tara, what kind of a world does that look like?
I'm really glad that I'm on a panel with a bunch of really smart people that think about the future of technology. But what I'm most concerned about, and even in that future world, is when we are the one, what is that one look as are we have we become like one brain, one idea, one? I'm more concerned about looking at the human beings. What are we valuing in the world? Are we valuing diversity? Are we? I think Jaron, you indicated that this was also a concern. These are, I think, really way more important, because that's what, no matter what technology is in place, we're human beings in. Interacting with human beings.
Neil Stevenson, you want to follow on that?
I guess I'm going to be a little grouchy here and take issue with one word in the quote that you read, which is transparency. Mm-hmm. So transparency sounds great. It's a word that's picked up some new connotations, I would say, in the last 10 or so years, where we use it to mean any place that doesn't have corruption, where everything's out in the open and plain dealings predominate. And so it sounds great to say that we're going to be in an era of transparency brought to us by the web, but you know, not all things that are transparent are give you an undistorted image. Let's put it that way. And
selective transparency.
And we don't always want ubiquitous transparency in our
Tara
lives.
Tara knows all about that.
Yeah.
Ubiquitous
yeah.
transparency is just
selective transparency.
Selective transparency is where it's at. Yeah. Got it. Ray, can you put some flesh on that bone of what kind of a world Kevin Kelly's talking about there?
I'll go in direction about privacy of information. So when we had villages, somebody would do a bad thing or a mistake when they were a kid. Nobody would know really about it except a few people in that village. You would move to the next one, it would be okay. But today, things are incredibly different, where this idea of global village is around. And the kids don't know about this, that the what they put on the web is there for their eternity. So it'll be there forever. So if they do something which doesn't, that they will regret in the future, they will have to live with it.
You think they don't get that?
I don't think they fully get it. I don't think you and me get it. That when we decide to have our medical record going through the internet from one place
perhaps
to the other.
Perhaps the idea of being proper is going to change as well,
yeah.
right? So, you know, my son might discuss, you know, he's 16, I don't go to his Facebook page because it upsets me.
What upsets you about it?
Oh, well, he talks about stuff that a 16-year-old talks about. Yeah, well, that I did when I was 16.
And his mother shouldn't know about it.
But I don't want to hear about it. But at the same time, all of his friends are talking about it. So when it comes time for him and his friends to look for work, are they all going to go and apply for the same job? And the employer can no longer disqualify them based on their Facebook pages because they're all the same.
They're all like
you
that.
Know. So is the notion of what's right and wrong going to change? This is why I'm worried about values. Not that I think what he's doing is like low values, but I just, these are the things that I'm worried about is more human behavior.
I think it will change.
Yeah.
It will change.
It will change.
Yeah.
Those kinds of things. Jaron, I got a couple of minutes left here and I've got a very philosophical question that's got your name all over it. Here we go. Some would argue that being wired has led to a loss of freedom. So what's the meaning of freedom and autonomy in a world where we seem to be so tethered to technology?
Well, freedom means believing in yourself more than the technology. Kevin Kelly's a dear friend of mine, but I think this notion of calling it the one with the capital O gives it a religious connotation. And I think it's good to have a sort of a way of thinking about technology. We think of it like dirt. You know, it's this cheap stuff. We can use it. We can use it well. We can use it badly. We can mold it. We can change it. We can try to make it better. But it's not anything of tremendous status on its own. It's not there unless we use it. It's not alive by itself. We have to, if we make it too real, if we respect it too much, inevitably we end up respecting ourselves a little less. And if we care too much about our Facebook page as a shrine to ourselves or something, inevitably our real life suffers. You know, it's essential to essentially to believe in yourself. You have to avoid the artifact that you create. Your digital doppelganger should never replace you. And I think that's the great challenge of the coming age for all of us.
And here's a very unphilosophical question for the final question for you tonight.
Yeah.
Do you have a Facebook page?
No, my cat used to, but not me.
No. Used to.
Yeah.
I'd be curious with this group here. How many of you got Facebook pages?
Oh, good Lord, no.
Let's see. Neil?
I don't turn on my telephone, you can guess.
Okay, Tara?
Oh, absolutely.
You obviously do.
My dog does too.
I never have created one, but I was looking over somebody's shoulder recently when they were accessing my Facebook page, so.
Yeah, that's right.
That's good. Ray?
I need a 25th hour during my day to set one up.
I see. Okay. Well, that's our time this evening, and I want to thank all of our guests for coming from, in some cases, very far distances to be with us tonight. We're really grateful for your time this evening on the broadcast. Grateful to this audience as well for taking time out of their schedules to join us here at the PI in Waterloo. Now, as we close the program, got a lot of things to tell you about online, so stay tuned here. We have more information on our homepage about tonight's guests. We have writer Kevin Kelly's talk, The Next 5,000 Days on the Web, web-exclusive video of leading scientists answering this question, where do you see our lives in the next 50 to 100 years? And complete Q2C festival coverage. So go to our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda, for all of that. Tonight's program is produced once again by Sandra Jonas. Thank you, Sandra. And you can read her post that I referenced earlier called "The Future is Fabulous." That's on our Inside Agenda blog, also at tvo.org/theagenda. Now, please stay with us. We're going to give you a sneak peek of what's up tomorrow night here at the PI, and then we'll be right back after that.
Sure, quantum mechanics is weird. This way of thinking about the world, of understanding it at the level of quantum information, has the potential to transform every technology that we possess. And by transforming it and by learning to talk with these atoms and elementary particles, we'll find a new place for ourselves in the quantum world.
Real physicists do it at a quantum level. The Quantum Tamers, tonight at 10 on TVO.
For 10 days in October, Waterloo will be the center of the scientific universe. The Quantum to Cosmos Festival will bring the world's brightest minds together to discuss everything from quarks to black holes. TVO is proud to be the official broadcaster of the event. The agenda will come to you live from the Perimeter Institute during the week of October 19th through 23rd. Our guests will be world-renowned leaders in their fields, giving us great insight into some of the foremost science-related questions of the day. The Quantum to Cosmos Festival, on the agenda. Plan on being a part of it, October 19th through 23rd at 8 p.m.
Funding for the Agenda with Steve Paikin is provided by Vale Inco Limited, a pioneering nickel mining company transforming mineral resources into essential ingredients for everyday life. Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
And one last quick note about online. Last night we had twice as many people as normal in Mike Miner's chat room on our homepage. Tonight it was three times as many as normal, so keep it going. Keep the conversation going. Mike's still there doing it. We even had more as we went off the air last night. That is the agenda for Tuesday, October 20th, 2009. Tomorrow night, of course, part three of the agenda at Q2C. A look at the question, whose DNA is it anyway? Would you like to know all your genetic secrets, and can you trust yourself with that important information? For complete coverage of the Q2C Festival and special features, including our Ask a Scientist segments, live streaming video, and TVO's complete scientific literacy programming, visit us at tvo.org/theagenda and click on the Q2C link. Tomorrow afternoon, 2:30 p.m., I'm going to be sitting in for Cheryl Jackson, who's got the flu, unfortunately, for a special Your Voice webcast on the question of whether or not technology is dumbing down our kids. And you can join that conversation online tomorrow at 2:30 p.m. That's at tvoparents.com. And finally, a reminder that tickets are now available at tvo.org/theagenda for next Thursday's Monk Center show. We're back at the Monk Center, 10th year. Our program next Thursday night, Europe, 20 years after the fall of communism. Should be a good discussion. Hope you can be there for that one. And that's it tonight. I'm Steve Paikin. Thanks for watching TVO, for joining us online at tvo.org, and we'll see you again tomorrow night from the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario.